Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, a Dickinson College professor is part of a significant study of rattlesnakes. But up front, one of the National Collegiate Athletic Association's enshrined rules was that college athletes would be amateurs, that they would not be paid for their play on the field or court, or be compensated in any way other than their athletic scholarships. That's even though college sports, especially football and basketball, were on a level playing field or topped professional sports in attendance, TV viewership, and most importantly, money. Universities were making billions of dollars while the athletes who did the hard work and risked their bodies and health got nothing. That all changed. First with a U.S. Supreme Court decision last month, and then a monumental rule change by the NCAA last week that will allow athletes to be compensated for the use of their names, likenesses, or images. Joining us today to discuss what this means is Casey Floyd, co-founder and chief compliance officer with No Cap Sports. Mr. Floyd, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott. Really appreciate you having me. Excited to talk about NIL and college athletes today.
NIL, names, likenesses, or images. That is the way it's been shortened. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Do you think this is a good change for college athletes, for college sports overall? Give us a call. Let us know what you think. Casey Floyd, how significant are the events of the past 2 weeks?
Oh, they're absolutely huge. It's the biggest moment in the history of college athletics, and that's going back. The NCAA has been around for over 100 years. I want to say about 115 years. This is the biggest moment in the history of the NCAA and college athletics.
When you say the biggest moment, I mean, that takes in a lot. I mean, when you think about things that have happened on the field or on the court and rule changes and things like that, this is that significant.
Absolutely. This is the first time in the history of college athletics and student athletes in their movement for rights. This is an issue of rights. And student athletes were the only Americans that didn't have the right to their own publicity, their own name, their own image, their own likeness. They couldn't do endorsement deals. They couldn't sign contracts. They couldn't offer private lessons and publicize that they're a student athlete at these schools. This is a huge moment that opens up a lot of opportunities and a lot of doors and puts them online with other students, but more importantly, every other American.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Supreme Court decision was huge, but the NCAA capitulating maybe wasn't totally unexpected. But it was the biggest change in their history. And, I mean, you referenced that just a moment ago. So taking the two together, the Supreme Court decision, did that force the NCAA into making this decision?
The Supreme Court decision was very related to name, image, likeness, but I would say it was more it made it so that NCAA couldn't continue to restrict the athletes in certain ways. And so it did open the door, or at least make it so the NCAA couldn't continue to restrict athletes around their name, image, and likeness. But the Alston case, the issue with the Alston case is that it was limited to education-related benefits. And this goes back to the O'Bannon case back in 2014 when that first started. That is what limited. The court was limited and restricted to only looking at the issues at hand. And because of the O'Bannon ruling being restricted to just education-related benefits, Alston and the court had to look at just that issue. If we go back in time, Alston originally was about a free market and completely opening up the market so athletes could really get what they deserve for their name, image, likeness, but also whether or not they could be compensated. And because of the O'Bannon ruling, they actually had to change the Alston case to look at it in a very limited scope and not be about a completely free market, but limited to just education-related benefits. So schools cannot cap education-related benefits. That's really what came out of it. But they didn't speak to the other compensation limits, but did say that all of them would have to be subject to the full rule of reason. And that's the critical aspect. So now it opens up the door for future lawsuits like the NCAA versus House case that's currently in California.
All right. So I just want to provide some context for our listeners. Since we are not a sports talk show, a lot of people may not understand or realize or be familiar with some of these cases. The O'Bannon case, Ed O'Bannon was a basketball player at UCLA. Talk about what that was. What was the O'Bannon case? And then what was the Alston case?
Sure. The O'Bannon case was really about name, image, likeness, and that was really one of the first cases that started all of this and really helped bring publicity to the issue and helped everyone understand what was going on. Because I think a lot of people, especially even college sports fans, a lot of people didn't know that college athletes couldn't do endorsement deals, couldn't sign with Nike, couldn't promote a local business in their community, couldn't, you know, offer camps and clinics and put their face on the poster. So the Ed O'Bannon case, it was originally, he was actually at his, it's a funny story. He was at his cousin's house who was playing this college basketball game. And there was a player just like him, left-handed, 6'10", African-American, had the same mid-range game and great little hook shot. So, but there wasn't a name on it. It looked just like him. And yet he wasn't getting any money off of this. Clearly, they were using his likeness, his skill set in this basketball game. Same number, same jersey at UCLA. And he wasn't making any money. And so he wanted to be compensated since the NCAA and EA Sports and the video games were making millions off of selling this image of him to consumers.
So what's the Alston case then?
So the Alston case started, that the original case with O'Bannon was about really name, image, likeness. And the court in that case agreed that the NCAA was violating antitrust laws and would need to open this up. But then when they went to the actual remedies phase, which in antitrust law, it's a complicated analysis. The first one, I don't want to go into it too much, but you weigh anti-competitive versus pro-competitive benefits on both sides. It's a detailed analysis. But when you get to the remedies phase, they went back to this analysis and looked at, is there a less restrictive means? Instead of blowing up the whole system, is there a less restrictive means? And so that's when this education-related cap came on, where schools, you know, would have to give the full cost of attendance. So with O'Bannon, one of the big things that came out of it was before, student-athletes were limited to just tuition, room, board, fees, their books, basic things. But there's other costs to going to college. Flying home for winter break to see your family. You know, if you want to go out with your friends on Friday night, there's other just living expenses that go into it. And each college estimates it at about somewhere between like $2,000 to $5,000. So now with the O'Bannon case, schools were allowed to offer a full cost of attendance scholarship. So all the tuition, the fees, the room, the book, plus the costs of the extra things that just come up along with being a college student. And so that $5,000 was then added on as a cost of living stipend kind of to mainly football, basketball, a lot of the revenue producing athletes. And then the education related benefit cap. And so that's what kind of started. Then Alston came about. Alston was originally filing for a free market They thought that athletes should be able to be paid, by the schools, you know, for the TV contract money, the ticket revenue, all of the billions of dollars that are actually in it. And then that's how the case originally started. But by the time the O'Bannon case was decided, the Alston case had already been filed. And so now, with the way that our legal system works, case precedent from the O'Bannon case applied to the Alston case. So Alston wasn't about a free market anymore. They actually had to just go about this education-related benefits area. And so that is how Alston kind of progressed through. And the Supreme Court said, you cannot cap education-related benefits. So that's kind of the transition and how it progressed.
The Supreme Court ruling, Justice Brett Kavanaugh's opinion for the majority, was described almost everywhere as scathing against the NCAA. Let's face it, the NCAA is not a popular institution, especially here in Pennsylvania after the Penn State case, this Jerry Sandusky case that came down in 2012. But Justice Kavanaugh said that the NCAA was the only business in America, and I'm paraphrasing, this is an exact quote, that the NCAA is the only business in America that touts how successful it is by not paying the people who made it successful. In other words, that the NCAA maintained that athletes were to stay amateurs and wouldn't be paid, but that's one of the reasons that they were, that college sports was so successful. When Kavanaugh put it out there that way, I think that got a lot of people's attention that, you know, this really doesn't make a whole lot of sense, that in America, in a free market society, that these universities and TV networks making billions of dollars, but yet these young people, many of them from not very well-to-do homes, are making nothing and taking all the risk. So Kavanaugh's decision really got to have a lot of attention.
Absolutely. I think you bring up a really important part that hasn't been discussed enough, is who is benefiting from this and what are their demographics and financial situations. And then the labor force that is actually producing the product, right? The student athletes. There wouldn't be NCAA March Madness. There wouldn't be college football playoffs without these incredible athletes. And yet they aren't making any of it. And if you look at the bigger picture, a lot of them come from economically challenged areas, families, histories, and they aren't making any of this. Yet there are coaches and administrators making millions of dollars every year. Look at Mark Emmert, president of the NCAA. He makes $4 million a year. How do you justify that when the athletes aren't getting paid anything?
Now, you know, I don't want to get into the basics of the argument, but one of the things that we've heard over the years is that these athletes are being compensated in that they are getting, now I'm not talking about the under the table stuff, but that they're getting scholarships that are worth maybe $100,000 over 4 years, scholarships, and if they stay in school, do well, graduate, getting a degree. So isn't that worth something?
Absolutely. It's worth a lot. This is what I try to explain to people when that comes up. I think it comes down to self-awareness. And what that means is being able to put yourself in the other person's perspective. If I was, you know, for me looking in, I don't have any athletic ability. I wouldn't be worth, you know, I played high school basketball and that's about it. So, my athletic ability doesn't really generate revenue. It's not worth very much. So I would be really happy to get a scholarship and be provided. I mean, that's worth thousands of dollars, lots of money, hundreds of thousands if it's a full scholarship. But if my athletic ability was worth $10 million and it's bringing in, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for a university, then I think it's unfair. And to say that, you know, I should be happy with a scholarship is really just not looking at it from the other person's perspective and being self-aware enough to just recognize that, appreciate it, and feel like, okay, maybe there should be some kind of middle ground that we can compromise so everyone is treated equitably.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Casey Floyd, co-founder and chief compliance officer with No Cap Sports. We're discussing monumental changes in college sports over the past couple weeks. First, the Supreme Court made a ruling that had a big impact on college sports, and then the NCAA decided that it would not fight it any longer, and college athletes can now be compensated for the use of their names, likenesses, or images. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so we've provided a lot of context. You provided a lot of context here for what's happened over the past couple of weeks. But let's talk about what's practical, what this all means. So let's start with, what does it mean for the college athletes?
It means that the college athletes have publicity rights like every other American, every other student at their university. So they can do endorsement deals, they can sign contracts, they can promote companies, local businesses, all the way up to national brands. I'm thinking of right now, PetSmart just did a deal on our platform with an Arkansas athlete, Trey Knox, a wide receiver there. And so those kind of opportunities to make some money based on your celebrity while you still have it. There's a limited window for a lot of these athletes. You know, they have 4, maybe 5 years to really capitalize, because a lot of them won't play professionally. Most sports in the NCAA don't even have a professional league. And a lot of them that do, you know, you can't really make a living. I was just talking to a lacrosse player that's playing professionally right now. He works a job, flies on Friday to go play in another city, Saturday, Sunday, back-to-back days, flies back home to work his regular job just so he can play professionally.
And, you know, the point you bring up, and I wanted to make sure we talked about this, this is not just Division I college football and basketball. This is for all three divisions, four if you count college football with the four divisions, of college sports. I mean, as you mentioned, lacrosse, soccer, I've seen field hockey, you know, all college sports and all divisions as well. Now, granted, someone, an athlete in college in Division III may not get the opportunities, may not make the money that one, a visible athlete in Division I, a star athlete, would, but still has that opportunity to be able to endorse products or their likeness to be used and for them to be compensated. So it's more than just football and basketball, but for the most part, that's where the big money probably will be. You mentioned Trey Knox of the University of Arkansas. I'm curious, what kind of deal did he get? I mean, have to admit, I don't know a whole lot about Arkansas football right now, and I don't know Trey Knox.
Well, Trey Knox is a starting wide receiver at Arkansas, and I can't give the specifics on the deal.
Oh, I understand that.
It's,
yeah.
Obviously it's illegal, but he's doing some Instagram posts, TikTok post, a few tweets, and that was really the deal. He took his dog, Blue, who, you know, he would do anything for. He took the dog to PetSmart, bought some specific toys that they're trying to advertise right now. He promoted on his social media. And so that's really the premise of the deal. I want to circle back. I just want to touch on one thing. I think this is so important for every student athlete. We touched on it, that field hockey, lacrosse, all of these other sports. I think there's such a larger market for these other student athletes that aren't the big names that you see on Saturday during college football game day, but every student athlete has influence in his or her local communities, these college towns, these cities. Local businesses want to do deals with them because they have a lot of influence with the community, the students at that school, the local fans. So it's not just the Trevor Lawrence and the big name student athletes. Every student athlete has influence in the local communities or cities or college towns. And, you know, look back to when we were in college. You know, $100 extra a week is a huge deal. That's the difference between going out on the weekend or not.
You were spending $100 on a weekend, Casey?
I wish. I was working full-time and double majoring and doing a whole bunch of other stuff in college.
I didn't have a normal situation.
But it would have been nice to have some extra cash in my pocket to be able to have, you know, be able to go out on a date and do certain things. You know, a lot of people don't have a credit card at that time either, and they probably shouldn't be using it on that stuff anyway. But there's it opens up so many opportunities and allows them to make money on things that before they couldn't have. I know a lot of students in my time. I've been in NCAA compliance for almost a decade. I've been at multiple Power Five institutions. I've been at a conference office. Most recently, I was the director of compliance at the University of Michigan. I can't even tell you how many student athletes could have made money on their name, image, likeness during my time there. I mean, camps and clinics, I can't even tell you how many people want to do private lessons with these individuals. There's so many avenues to make money. It's not just social media influencing. It's a lot of different ways.
Let's take a phone call from Ron in York. Ron, you're on Smart Talk.
Thanks, Scott. I vehemently oppose this decision, and it's a hard thing for me to do because I, like you, I have nothing good to say about the NCAA normally, but you've touched on it, and the idea that college athletes, especially the Division I athletes at places like Penn State, are not compensated is ridiculous. Having just a little over a year ago completed paying the full freight for my daughter of more than $130,000 for 4 years at Penn State as an in-state student, a Schreyer Honors College student, a member of the Blue Band, where not only did she get nothing, but we actually had to rent her uniform each year. Let me tell you, athletes are doing fine. And what's going to happen here is what's going to happen to college, has happened to college basketball. It's a travesty. When we were kids, we lived, there were great teams. Remember when Bill Walton and David Thompson played NC State and UCLA?
Oh, yeah.
We waited all season for that game. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen anymore. The one and done. And how many of those athletes actually make it in the NBA? And what's going to happen is the people are going to make money. They're going to be the local car dealer. They're going to take this guy, going to show up on a Saturday and sign autographs, and they'll sell 10 extra cars. And half of these students will end up signing early. It's already happening. They're skipping bowl games now. How many of these guys don't make it in the NFL and don't really make any money? They're going to be out. They're going to have no degree. It's become a more unfair system. And the next thing that's going to be challenged, because most states and colleges have rules about what they can endorse, they're going to challenge it. They can't endorse alcohol. They can't endorse gambling. They can't endorse, you know, the local excitement video store. Why not? And then there's going to be some real problems. So I'm sorry. I think this is a sad day for college athletics.
Hey, Ron, thank you very much, and thanks for your perspective. You know, the points he brings up, Casey, there are people out there who have the exact same opinions as Ron, that this opens the door to the Wild West.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. And Ron, I appreciate you calling in, and I appreciate your perspective. I would I would like to have a conversation about at least one of the points that you mentioned, which was that a lot of people are leaving early. They're not playing the bowl game. A lot of these things are going to, you know, continue to, it's going to exasperate that, and they're going to not stay at the college. I think it's the opposite, though. I really think this is going to actually keep student athletes in school longer. A lot of student athletes leave for the professional level early because they come from a financial background where they need to. Their families are relying on them. They need to start making money. That is the extreme situation that a lot of these kids are in. I can tell you because I've been in this industry for a decade. And so a lot of them feel like they have to make that leap as soon as possible because they have adults, they have families relying on them to actually put food on the table. And imagine being a 19 or 20 year old, and that's your decision. Do I stay in school and get a degree, or do I try to go make money and help support my family? And so when those kind of decisions are put in front of a 19 or 20 year old, a lot of them don't have a choice. They have to do it for their family. But now that they can actually make some money on their name, image, likeness while they're in school, I think a lot of them are going to stay longer and finish those degrees.
Here's another email from a listener. This listener, Gregory, says, I'm a big supporter of the changes that athletes can profit off their likeness. One of the concerns people have raised is that the ability of revenue sport athletes to make money will take away from donations to the school's athletic departments, and that will hurt the ability of schools to fund non-revenue sports like swimming, tennis. How would you respond to that?
I don't think there's this pie of just this is all the name, image, likeness money in the world. And if we start giving some of it to the athletes, then, you know, that is taking away from the school. I do think there's a balance, but this is what happens in a free market. This kind of stuff gets worked out over time. So, yeah, I think the schools are concerned that a lot of their donors and boosters are going to start supporting the athletes and not support the schools. But if that became a real issue, then it would be a disservice to the school. And so I think the booster and the brands and the businesses would support the schools if you know, it became such an issue that they were harming the school by only supporting the athletes. And then the second point I make is, I think that the market is just going to increase because a lot of the brands and businesses that these athletes are working with are not the donors or the people, you know, really supporting the schools. These are the brands and businesses that want to tap into this new influencer market that has a lot of influence. I'll tell you a very interesting stat. The typical influencer has an engagement rate of about like 1 to 2%. And what that means is, these people with like a million followers that only like a handful, 1% actually comment, like their post and actually engage. But college athletes, their engagement rate is like 20%. It's the highest of any segment of influencer. And it's because their fans, the people that grew up watching them, their communities, they are all in. They are diehard fans. They love following the athletes. They are constantly watching the games and wanting to interact and have that communication with these, you know, celebrities really at their schools.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about human nature. What you just talked about the, you know, the concern of donors donating, won't donate to the college or university as much because athletes will be able to be compensated or they may go directly to the athlete. Ron's call reminded me of something, too, when he talked about $130,000 for his daughter's tuition at Penn State, tuition and everything else being in the band. I could sense a little bit of resentment on his part. What about teammates? I mean, let's face it, when it comes to sports, and one of the things we hear most often today is we're a great team. Everybody likes each other, pulled for one another. Human nature would say that there could be some jealousies. There could be some divisions over, you know, one athlete on a team making money while, you know, the other 70 players on a college football team are making nothing. I mean, is that a big concern?
I think it could be. I mean, in those situations, I think the person is really dealing with inner issues that they need to deal with, doing some deep work and inner work and meditating on those things. But from what I've seen, I can only speak to personal experiences. I've been around a lot of teams, a lot of student athletes. I mean, just at Michigan, we had over 950 student athletes. So I've been around it for a decade now and really in the weeds and helping these individuals succeed. I can tell you, they are the most helpful and team-oriented individuals I've ever been around. So if it is an issue, I think it'll be a very small issue that gets worked out. And I don't foresee it being some huge issue that is prevalent on every campus. I think a lot of the teammates that I've talked with, they're excited to like work together, do deals together. And, you know, the person on the team that has a huge following, from what I've been around, they're helping their teammates understand how to, you know, what kind of posts work, how to be a social media influencer, how they've succeeded, and then tagging them in posts to help them succeed and gain followers so they can also monetize their name, image, likeness. I think you're going to see a lot of teammates working together and not jealous and kind of fighting each other. I think that is a narrative that is not going to be true.
What about athletes who will now go to schools where their visibility is the highest, where they have the most potential for making the most money? And then the next step beyond that is then the universities that are successful on the field, on the court, continue to the rich get richer. If I could, you know, make that analogy, not so much with money as with wins and losses. You know, I'm thinking of the Michigans, the Ohio States, you know, the Penn States, you know, schools that have high visibility. And what does it mean for, you know, schools like a Vanderbilt or, you know, a school that doesn't have a rich athletic tradition?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think right now, if we look at college football, for example, what's the current system? The current system is we see the same Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State, Michigan. We see the same schools in the college football playoffs. I'm glad they're expanding the number of teams that make it. I think that's going to help a lot. But there already is a disparity. There already is haves and have-nots. I actually believe, and I think a lot of people might agree with me, this is actually going to help bring everyone closer. I think there's still going to be some disparity between the haves and have-nots, but I think this is actually going to reduce the gap a bit, because now you're going to have athletes that maybe they would be second string at Michigan, but they're going to be the starter at, a Northern Illinois, you know, a smaller Division I school. But at that school, they're a starter. They're one of the headline players that the school promotes on social media all the time. They're going to gain more followers. So it's kind of, from the athlete's perspective, I think because they're going to have more opportunities at some of the smaller schools to be that star, you have to think, do you want to be a smaller fish in a large pond? You know, there's a lot of opportunities there, and there's a huge fan base, which is fantastic, but you're one of several guys. Whereas if you go to a smaller school, maybe you're the big fish in a smaller pond, but you still have a larger overall NIL opportunity in front of you.
Interesting conversation, and I agree with you, Casey, that you know, this is a monumental time in college sports, and we'll see what transpires. Probably won't know until a few years down the road. Casey Floyd is co-founder and chief compliance officer with No Cap Sports. By the way, quickly, No Cap Sports, I should have provided right up front. What does the No Cap do?
Oh, thank you so much, Scott. I really appreciate that. For all of the fans and businesses and brands out there, if you want to work with a student athlete at any school, Division I, Division II, Division III, you can find them on No Cap Sports. It's a completely open and free marketplace for every student athlete, so they have the technology and tools to succeed in the NIL era. And so any brand or business can find them. If you want to hire a student athlete to coach your son or daughter, private camps, lessons, you can go on and buy merchandise directly from student athletes. You could follow them in subscribers. You can hire them to promote your company on their social media accounts. It's an incredible opportunity for a lot of businesses, brands, and fans to engage and work with college students. And we have thousands online right now. One of the deals I mentioned was that PetSmart and Trey Knox, but there are lots of deals going on. And we're excited to just help in this name, image, likeness era and connect everyone. So our platform is for fans, brands, athletes, and agents. And it automates all of the NCAA compliance paperwork for everyone. So student athletes are protected with their eligibility. And brands and businesses don't have to worry about accidentally injuring a student athlete's eligibility because that could look really bad for a business. So that's why we started this company, to make sure everyone has a marketplace that they can engage in a compliant way. And we automate all the paperwork and tax forms for everyone.
Casey Floyd, co-founder, chief compliance officer, No Cap Sports. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Appreciate the time, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The power of community is being tapped to better understand the secretive rattlesnake. Project Rattlecam is seeking help from community scientists to sort through literally thousands of images taken inside a rattlesnake rookery. There's a word you can learn today, a rookery. In summer, female rattlesnakes gather in rookeries to have babies, and scientists have placed cameras in one area to capture all the action. This project partners Dickinson College in Carlisle with California Polytechnic State University and the University of California at Santa Cruz. Scott Bobeck is an animal ecologist and professor of biology with Dickinson College. He's part of this project. Dr. Bobeck, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. So, Dr. Bowick, what's unique about this project?
Well, I would say, Scott, to make an analogy with your previous guest, it really is the power of the internet. Our ability to reach out to hundreds of thousands of people and engage them in scientific research is really the unique aspect of this.
So, as I mentioned in the introduction, webcam set up. Now, where are these webcams set up?
Yeah, so these are actually remote cameras. People around here, a lot of the hunters that are listeners would understand, these are basically game cameras that people use to take photos of deer and turkeys and things like that. We set them to a remote setting so that they automatically take photos every 5 minutes throughout the day. And they're located in Colorado because we are studying a species of rattlesnake out there called the prairie rattlesnake. It's, of course, closely related to the rattlesnake that we have in Pennsylvania, which is the timber rattlesnake.
Mm-hmm. So on these cameras, can you give me a ballpark figure of how many rattlesnakes those who would go to the site can see?
Yeah, that's a good question, Scott. So within the photo, the users or volunteers on this project could see probably anywhere from 1 to 30 snakes within an image. But what we're looking at is you know, some of these cameras are set up over these dens, which we have some of them set up over these rookeries, which is where pregnant female snakes aggregate. We think that they hang out in these social groups where they sort of take care of babies together. They basically either hang out with their friends while they're pregnant. Those are the rookeries. But then we also have some cameras over the dens. And in the dens, we're still working on the exact number, Scott, but we're pretty sure that we're well over 1,000 snakes in the den.
Okay, so many people, as you well know, are squeamish about snakes, period, let alone rattlesnakes. I imagine this is not for those who are squeamish about snakes, but those who are interested in science and participating in something that is unique.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Throughout my career, I encounter folks that have all different kinds of opinions about snakes, and yeah, many people are extremely phobic of snakes, and you know, there's obvious reasons for that. Snakes can be dangerous, but the interesting thing about these guys is that, you know, oftentimes what we have seen in the media, on television, is a representation of these animals that's really not what they really do in the wild. We often, you know, provoke them for a nice video of like the snake coming up in a very defensive position, rattling its tail. And many of your listeners probably know, when you come across these on the bike path or on the road, they're often just lying there, not doing anything until we come up to them. And then they can get provoked if we start messing with them. But what these images really do is it provides a window into their little world when we're not there. And so it's really kind of interesting to think about. Every time that we're looking at these animals, we are presence. Me standing up there, you know, all 6'3" of me, like leaning over the snake, is something that would cause them to be quite reactive. With the cameras, we can kind of put these up and taking photos with no human presence. And so what we get to see is we get to see their natural behavior, which is really quite different than, you know, like I say, what they're normally seen as in sort of the social areas in public and social media and television.
And by the way, this is probably a good time for me to tell everyone that we have a link to Project Rattlecam on our website, WITF.org/smarttalk. So you can go there right now and take a look at what Dr. Bobeck is talking about. So what kind of information are you trying to obtain? What is this research looking for?
Yeah, so our goals are sort of twofold, I guess. We are very interested in characterizing the rattlesnake's social behavior. So, and of course, the volunteers help us do that. In addition, we're also looking at a specific behavior that's called rain harvesting behavior. And this is actually when rattlesnakes coil up in a loop, and they collect rainwater on their skin, and then they drink off of it. We're very interested in that behavior as well, and we have already seen that in our sort of beta testing of the project, volunteers are able to see this. They see these pictures of the snakes doing these really interesting behaviors. And they're documenting it for us. So really, this is a project that would not be possible without the help of volunteers. We have uploaded about 50,000 images so far, and we have probably we're going to get at least another 50,000, so probably about 100,000 total. And you can imagine, Scott, that would take us forever, a really, really long time to go through those images. And so this is really harnessing the power of volunteers and people that just are curious and want to see if they can see some of these behaviors.
Well, I mean, it's you talked about this earlier, but it is so unique. It's kind of cool that you can get so many people to participate in a project like this, because let's face it, at least most people think of research, that's behind closed doors in a lab, or if you're studying something in the wild, that okay, maybe you're out there just yourself, maybe a team, maybe some students. But with so many people being able to participate, it's kind of a cool thing that they can. Is there anything that you've learned so far, Dr. Bobick, that you didn't know or we haven't seen before on video maybe or in a picture?
Well, so there's still so much to learn. There's so many new things I believe that we are going to find through this project. But one of the things that led us to even start this process and get all of these images is that we did see some of these snakes exhibiting this rain harvesting behavior. And specifically what we saw were the newborn snakes or these baby rattlesnakes exhibiting this behavior immediately after they were born. So within the first week of their life, if there's a little tiny rain shower, we saw a number of babies coming out and harvesting the rain, which is really interesting because what that means is that this is a behavior that's innate. This is something that the animals didn't learn from their mothers, but instead this is an innate behavior that they're born with. They come out and then they have the ability to harvest rain. So that's a little start into some of the things that we've learned. This project is really part of a much larger project, sort of investigating the behaviors and biology of rattlesnakes at this site. And one of the interesting things about the site is it's at really high elevation. So we are at about 7,300 feet where the den is located. And so these are high altitude snakes, which as you might imagine, you know, poses really interesting influences on the animals. An animal that you, as you say, is cold-blooded or ectothermic, that, you know, whenever it's cold outside, they're going to be cold. And so what we think of is you know, weather at 7,300 feet is, you know, snow and sleet. And certainly we see that on the images. And so some of the images that users will look at, there's going to be snow out there. And another thing that we have seen is we have actually seen snakes out on the snow, which has just blew me away. Under certain circumstances, they may venture out a very short distance from their den and then go back in to get a little bit warmer. But they may be able to actually harvest some moisture from if they get snow and it falls on their back and it melts a little bit. They may be actually able to drink some of that.
Wow. I have to admit, I'm like thinking here, have I ever seen a snake in the snow or on the snow? And no, probably not. So we only have a minute or so left. Very interesting. But Dr. Bobick, why rattlesnakes and what do you hope to learn? Why is this important? I guess is a big question.
Yeah, it's the great question, Scott. And really what we're trying to do here is that, you know, rattlesnakes are one of the most, if not the most misunderstood animal out there. And what we're hoping to do is to reveal, just, you know, show people what these animals are capable of, what they're not capable of, how they interact when we're not there, as a way to sort of better understand how we can better educate people in public about snakes. And, you know, maybe hopefully at some point people will understand the snakes better because and fear them less, because clearly we fear things we don't understand. And we are comforted by those organisms, those animals that look more like us, and they have those facial features that we can relate to. We can relate to the dog when our dog comes and starts wagging its tail and it has sort of its pursed lips. It looks like it's almost smiling at us. Well, we don't see that in these other organisms.
Nope,
but yet they are doing these really interesting behaviors that we would love to learn about.
never seen a snake, or a real snake smiling, that's for sure. Dr. Scott Bobak is an animal ecologist and professor of biology with Dickinson College. Dr. Bobak, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.